Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Mr. Media, that's mrmedia.com, I'll talk to Rob Elder about his new book, Last Words of the Executed. Stick around.
Hey, did you know that you can listen to the latest Mr. Media show right on your phone with the Stitcher app? Stitcher is smart radio for your smartphone. Mr. Media is on demand and on the go with Stitcher. Download Stitcher for your phone today. Get the free app at www.stitcher.com. That's STITCHER.com.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. The show is brought to you today by ThePartyAuthority.us. Planning a wedding, mitzvah, or corporate event? For any and all occasions, call The Party Authority nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJS. That's 1-800-342-5357. Where one call does it all. So where was I before the commercial? Oh yeah, Mr. Media is recorded live from the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I don't know that the world was bouncing on its heels, waiting impatiently for someone to finally collect the last words of men and women subject to the death penalty in the United States, but now that we have it, Robert K. Elder's last makes for a fascinating read. Don't take my words for it. The late great writer Studs Terkel, author of one of my favorite journalistic books, Working, and I read and carried it with me everywhere during my senior year of college, wrote the first words for Last Words of the Executed shortly before passing away himself. Here's what he said about it, in part. Elder is a journalist in the noblest tradition, getting at a certain truth, and the truth may come from the most ejected members of our society, the most reprehensible. And yet the humanity is still there. Perhaps there will come a time when a book such as this will no longer be needed, but will be remembered as a history of a prehistoric time. It's all moving stuff. Terkel went on to say that he found the book to be a poetry of sort. As for Elder, he's a journalist and a teacher at Northwestern University. This is his second trip to Mr. Media Radio. He was here before talking about something completely different. His websites, whenitwasover.com, and it was lovewhen.com. Rob Elder, welcome back to Mr. Media.
Bob, thanks for having me.
My pleasure, my pleasure. So, Rob, this is one of the strangest collections of work ever, and yet it's also one of the most compelling.
Well, and I have to say, the websites you mentioned, itwasoverwhen.com and itwaslovewhen.com, were an exact reaction to this. I had spent 7 years collecting these final words, and after 7 years, I needed a little bit of levity. So they're definitely related.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of levity in here, although it does have its moments. I mean, I noticed that I could spin the book to, you know, any number of pages and find something that you couldn't help but laugh at.
Right, right. I mean, there's a guy who's executed by firing squad, and he's asked for a last request, and he says, "Why, yes, a bulletproof vest."
Right.
And there are sort of literal examples of gallows humor in it. And if you add that to the fact that, four people choose to use their last words on earth to cheer for their favorite football team, you get sort of the range of human experience in there.
Well, I've got one in front of me. This was Stanley Tukey Williams, who a lot of people know as founder of the gang, the street gang, the Crips, the nurse was having trouble setting him up for lethal injection, and he finally said, "You doing that right?" You know, it's just like, hey, you know, I mean, it's not a funny moment, but it's a funny moment nonetheless. I mean, you can't...
Well, it's a very human moment. I mean, that's the thing that sort of struck me going through all of these, is you do get, as Studs points out, from the most outcast, reviled members of society, you do get these sort of, I don't want to say flashes of humanity, because, you know, it's humanity all the way through, but you get these sort of flashes of insight about their lives and their personalities, which ultimately, because this is a non-political book, this is ultimately what drew me to it.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, so you did not come at this from any kind of political or religious point of view?
No, not at all. And in fact, one of my assistants who worked on it with me had sort of assumed that there was one that was pre-existing. And as he sort of was working on the manuscript with me, you know, finding historic last words and fact-checking, he told me he expected that, you know, once he was done with the project, that he would come to some conclusion himself. And he said, you know what, it made me more confused than ever.
And so it was never motivated that way, because I'm sure that there are people who will read this and use it to support their point of view one way or the other.
Right. And I've already had different factions sort of upset with me for including different pieces of information that is either supportive of their point of view or not. I had some folks sort of pick a fight with me over, you know, including the Rosenberg case, because for a long time that was a hot-button liberal cause. And to me, anyway, it's pretty clear that they were guilty. Julius, for sure. Ethel, most likely. I mean, both of them received posthumous medals from the Soviet Union. A lot of information has come out. So people were upset with me just for including that fact.
You mean the Soviet Union doesn't give posthumous medals just for, you know, being good people?
Not that I have found, but you know, the wealth of information that's come out, it's made a lot of people, you know, look at that case again. And the same thing with, Sacco and Vanzetti. There was I think it was in 2005, a letter had surfaced from Upton Sinclair, who had written what he called a two-volume, you know, documentary novel about that case. And he confessed to a friend that he had met with one of their lawyers, who confessed to inventing an alibi for both of them. I want to include, stories of people who may have been innocent who were presumed innocent and probably were not. But really, that's sort of beside the point in the book. It really is. I mean, the people who are sentenced to die have three pieces of information that you and I don't, which is, you know, the fact that they're going to die, the manner of their death, and the fact that their last words will be recorded for posterity. And the central driving question is, you know, again, if these are the most reviled, dangerous members of society, why does it remain a cultural value to record what they say?
And did you come to a conclusion about that?
Well, actually, that's sort of the question I leave up to the reader. So hopefully, you know, in spending some time with a book, readers themselves come to that. So I'll turn the question to you. You know, what did you come away with it?
I didn't have an answer. I mean, I as a journalist, I thought it was interesting to read all of them in one place. And Sacco and Vanzetti was interesting, not so much because of their words, but because of the postscript that you just discussed, that there was some more recent information about their guilt or innocence that was pretty damning.
There's not a lot of that, because again, my central question wasn't about guilt or innocence, but it was about could you be influenced by the last words? And some people have said, you know, simply because I'm shining a light on this, it's automatically sympathetic, which I would say you haven't read the book.
Yeah, I don't think there's any sense of you being sympathetic. Now, Studs Terkel, who wrote the introduction, he seemed to have a very clear point of view about the death
penalty. Yes, absolutely. And he was a wonderful supporter all through while the book was being written. It's a very hard book to actually get published. A lot of folks passed on it because either it was too dark or it didn't support their political agenda. And Studs, who was a friend and a mentor to me, had written this introduction, and there are about 2.5 paragraphs in that introduction where he boldly comes out against the death penalty. And as we talked about it, he says, you know, you can cut this if you want. And I felt like, you know what, I asked you to do the introduction, it's your space, I'm going to let you say what you like. And so I did. But I think, again, the weight of the rest of the book is a counterbalance to that.
Well, it's hard, too. I mean, I did a book a couple of years ago, and Michael Chabon wrote the introduction, and he said, you know, you can cut it if you need to. And I thought, okay, well, let's see. Am I going to cut Michael Chabon? And you probably, there was probably a moment where you thought, am I going to cut Studs Terkel? Am I feeling that bold about things? And the answer is pretty much no. You know, you might alter a word here if there's a typo, or well, you might bring to someone's attention and say, you know, I'm not sure if this is quite clear, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know how you feel about it, but Chabon is one of those writers that I read, and I think, like, okay, I'm a writer, but I'm not a writer like Chabon is a writer. So,
right,
you know, we're sort of in different classes of animals here.
Yeah, it's exactly it. I mean, using him as an example, my wife was saying something yesterday about how she was reading his wife's blog or on Facebook or something about how his youngest kid had his bar mitzvah over the weekend. And I thought, see, no one is following my writing that closely that they know if my kid is, you know, having a bar mitzvah this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a different thing going on there.
Yeah, definitely.
So, and I have to ask, where did you come by your relationship with Studs Terkel? That's a you know, pretty important company to be traveling in.
Sure. Well, he's actually sort of two figures that entered my life that changed it immensely, and he was the second, and I interviewed him actually for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel when I was an intern there. I had been traveling the country doing different journalism gigs, and I had seen that he had retired and he had given his stash of interviews, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of interviews,
mm-hmm.
to the Chicago Historical Society, which is now the Chicago History Museum. And so I campaigned to my editor. I said, listen, you know, I think they had just released a lot of his audio interviews on tape, and I had just sort of been fascinated by them. And I said, let's just bring this guy through these stacks of interviews. And we did, and it was a wonderful, wonderful time, and it was a lot of sparring as well, because he is not, to say that he was not a very introspective person is not fair, but to say that he's a difficult interview is, because I would ask him, you know, sort of a personal question, and he would use it as an example to spin off on a story. And I would, after, you know, two or three times of that, and I'd spent the day with him, I said, Studs, you said that in this introduction to this book. Studs, you said that here. You said that here. and eventually he would say, ah, I heard that one, have you? And we had this, again, this sort of wonderful sparring relationship. And after the piece had run, we just sort of kept in contact. And then we'd become friends. And when I applied for a job at the Chicago Tribune, he even wrote me a letter of recommendation. So it was one of these connections that I, you know, was lucky to have.
You know, as you were telling that story, I was thinking of a brush with fame that I had as a freshman in college, University of Miami. It was the year Isaac Bashevis Singer won the Nobel Peace Prize for Literature, mm-hmm. and I was a freshman living in the dorm, and I read about him, and I thought, wow, he's right here in Miami. Gee, I wonder if he had any advice for a young writer. I was so bold and stupid, and I just picked up the phone, and he was in the phone book. It was so recent. And he answered the phone, and I talked to him then, and he said, you know, feel free to call me back. And I called him again later in the year and a couple years later, and it wasn't the same type of thing. But I was just thinking, you know, there's sort of a time of innocence, too, that's kind of passed us by where you could actually do that kind of thing.
Well, and, you know, Vonnegut, actually, Kurt Vonnegut kept his name in the phone book for years. And, you know, would call up people until he totally got tired of humanity. But that was one of his things. And then it's actually funny you should mention that, because the other figure that had sort of changed my life that I mentioned was Ken Kesey, who wrote One Flew the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
I had interviewed him when I was, must have been a junior in high school. And he basically gave me this piece of advice that I've very much lived my life by, which is, you know, don't wait for anybody's permission to become a journalist. You know, basically start now. You may not end up doing what you thought you'd be doing, but you'll be happy, and you'll be so far ahead of everybody else, it won't matter anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, it's, you know, the most amazing advice, and it's been true. And Ken, all of his life, kept his name and address in the phone book. So he would have, you know, people show up on his lawn and call him up all the time, which I always thought was generous and actually kind of risky.
Hmm. Now, having all these last words in one place to, you know, return the subject of the book, how do you think it'll be used? I mean, it's not necessarily, gee, I'm going to sit down and read this cover to cover like a novel.
And you should not, unless somebody takes away your belt and shoelaces. You should not attempt to read it cover to cover. No. No, I mean, I really don't know how it'll be used. The way I came to the book is I had been watching a documentary with a girlfriend, and the documentary is by a guy named Steve James, who most of us know as the director of Hoop Dreams. And this was a later work called Stevie, and it's basically about, it's a very personal documentary about how Steve feels like he failed a young man named Stevie, who was part of the Big Brothers Big Sister program. You sort of get that undercurrent. So it's him going back and visiting this kid, and I'm giving a little bit of the documentary away to say that somebody in the documentary ends up in jail. And my girlfriend at the time had been a lawyer for the Illinois prison system, and she says, you know what, I'm going to look him up, this prisoner. And I was just sort of fascinated by the amount of information that was available about him and about his case just on the Internet. And she said, that's nothing, you should see Texas. And she sort of steered me to this site that is still up today that has, for each prisoner on death row, appeals, photos, descriptions of crime, last words, last meals, a request.
Turn-ons, turn-offs.
You know, yes. But I was just amazed at the depth of the site. And again, after sort of doing a little bit of poking around, I was appalled that there was no modern study of last words, because, you know, it's part of the ritual. Then why doesn't it at all exist in one place? And that was, you know, one of the driving central forces. So I think it has some historical value. I think it has some empirical value. Just, you know, some place where you can find everything in one place. I will say, though, it's not encyclopedic. You know, since pre-colonial times, 16,000 people have been executed on these shores. So by no means do the 1,000 in my book, you know, represent the total sum, but it's, you know, it's a start.
Well, I want to ask you about that. A lot of people obviously have been executed in this country, and in the first section of the noose, you go back pretty darn far, but how do you decide who makes the cut and who doesn't? I mean, who is a... who's memorable? Who's like the guy who quoted from Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, and who's not?
And that quote is, you may be a king or a street sweeper, but we all dance with the Grim Reaper.
Right.
Basically, I just wanted to get a representative sampling. So, for example, the book begins in the 1600s, and you begin with the folks who've been called the Boston Martyrs. Basically, they were executed in Boston Common by the Massachusetts Bay Colony simply for being Quakers. That was really it. You know, they refused to stay banished, and they kept coming back and proselytizing. And so the folks who would be part of Boston, future Boston, executed them. And then, of course, you get criminals from that era. A little while later, you get the accused Salem witches. And I think we forget, it's more than just, the Crucible. It's more than just the Arthur Miller play. You know, 19 people were hanged to death, you know. It was... The book is arranged by method of execution, so it goes, hanging, firing squad, gas chamber, electric chair, and of course, finally lethal injection. And that sort of gives a rough chronology. You know, there are some overlapping chronology in there, but what I hope that achieves is you get a sense of how last words have changed. Because, for example, especially when hangings were public events, there's very much a sense of oration, or of speaking to the crowd. And then as executions went behind prison walls, they're more intimate, and you can hear people talking directly to victims' families and their own families. And that was really what I wanted to capture in my selection.
Did you come away from this at all thinking that we would be served by executions becoming public again, or our leaders protecting us from something we don't need to be protected from?
I think there are actually a couple people in the book who campaigned to be publicly executed. There's a guy, if I can find him here, who talks about being executed, and if this really is a public good, then the public should see it. In fact, if you'll indulge me here, this is a guy named Edward J. Brislane, and he was executed February 11th in 1921. And his last words were a written note to the sheriff. And he says, "Sir, is this a fair proposition? You have often been quoted as saying that public hangings would be a deterrent to crime. I disagree with you. I think that hangings, in public or in the secrecy of the county jail, are barbarous and obscene. And yet, for the benefit of the hypocrites who say they believe as I think you really do, what do you say to this? I am the next on the executioner's list. I go Friday unless the governor intervenes. I want all the people who are whooping it up for public executions to see an example, to see me go if I do. I don't think 5% of them will have the nerve to stick it out, but there will be less talk and more thinking afterwards. I suggest on this, if you must hang me, do it in Grant Park and invite the world. Yours sincerely, Edward Brislane." And those of your listeners who are not from Chicago, Grant Park is this giant city, or this giant park on the city lakefront, and it's in fact where Obama gave his acceptance speech, his inauguration speech.
So you'd think a guy smart enough to have final thoughts like that would have been smart enough to stay out of whatever trouble he got into to put him in that situation, but it's never the case.
No, and actually, I mean, that was the thing that is pretty amazing, is you end up with people who are very articulate and erudite, and then people who are subliterate. Again, I don't have hard and fast statistics, but I would say most of them don't have a high school diploma. You end up with people... like a guy named H.H. Holmes, who's the devil in Eric Larson's Devil in the White City, and he sort of gives this very interesting, final speech about, I'm guilty of this, but I'm innocent of this, and, if you'd be so kind, remember me for this, and in fact, if I can find it here, "Gentlemen, I have very few words to say. In fact, I would make no remarks at this time, except that by not speaking, I would appear to acquiesce in my execution." So, again, he's even sort of aware of the ritual itself, And he says, I only wish to say that the extent of my wrongdoing in taking human life consisted in the death of two women, they having died at my hands as a result of criminal operations. I wish to state here, so that thereafter there can be no chance of misunderstanding hereafter, that I am not guilty of taking the lives of any of the Pitzel family, the three children and Benjamin the father, of whose death I was convicted, and for which I am today to be hanged. That is all I have to say. And again, that is Herman Webster Mudgett, best known as H.H. Holmes. And for those who haven't read the book, Holmes killed more than 20 people in his hotel on Chicago's South Side and sold the remains to medical schools. It's understandable that he instructed that his body be cemented in his coffin to fend off grave robbers. He built his hotel to prepare for the Chicago's World's Fair, the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition, and many of his guests were also his victims. And again, Eric Larson wrote this just amazing book, Devil in the White City, all about that case.
Now, have you heard from any of the families of victims of these men and women who've been executed, or have you heard from the families of any of the executed who were either happy or unhappy with your collection?
No. I have to say, I expect to. Because I did write with them in mind, because I include in some of the biographies, the format of the book is quote, and then, you know, name, date of execution, etc., and then sort of a bio. And not all the bios are about the crime. Sometimes it's about their lives. Sometimes it's about the media attention that their execution got. And so there are a lot of quotes from victims' families, some who are for and some who are against capital punishment itself. So I try to be sort of very even-handed in writing each of the entries. So, you know, hopefully it would be very hard for someone to be offended. Again, I'm still very interested in hearing from them. In fact, during one of my interviews, I had suggested that, you know, there's this ritual, you know, again, recorded by the state for the condemned to make a final statement, but there's no parallel ritual for their families or for the victims' families, and, you know, what harm would it do to make that part of the ritual? That way, you know, everybody goes on the record, whether that's for or against, or that's angry or conciliatory, and they just feel included. And I do have to say, that one suggestion got me in trouble with a lawyer who just said, you know what, you don't want to open, you know, that can of worms. That is their time. And that's the only time they can sort of speak without sort of retrying the case. And while I can see, you know, the legal argument for that, I still don't see the harm in it.
Well, Rob, before we run out of time, I've got to ask you. You've done two wildly unconnected projects, Last Words of the Executed, this book we've been discussing, and then your websites, it was lovewhen.com and it was overwhen.com. I got to ask, what do you do after this?
Well, actually, it was Overwin and it was lovewin.com. Each get in 2011 they each get their own books. We got a 2-book deal. In January, I'm actually releasing a book called The Film That Changed My Life, and it's me talking with 30 directors about the movie that made them want to become a director. So it's Danny Boyle talking about Apocalypse Now, and Kimberly Pierce talking about The Godfather, and Peter Bogdanovich talking about Citizen Kane. So I wrote that book in parallel with Last Words, just because, you know, I couldn't spend so much time on such a dark subject. But somebody had told me, I agreed with them, that the through line, and I should actually find it because they wrote a letter to me, that the through line of my projects has basically been epiphany moments. That, and I think that's true. The thing that attracts me are these moments of discovery or of self-awareness, and you have that sort of across the board in all the projects that you've mentioned.
Well, folks, first of all, I suspect we'll have Rob back again based on the types of works that he has coming up, but you can order Robert K. Elder's new book, The Last Words, there's no The, it's Last Words of the Executed, at great bookstores everywhere or on MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. And check out his websites. It was lovewhen.com, it was overwhen.com, and of course, lastwordsoftheexecuted.com. You can also follow Last Words of the Executed on Twitter at LastWordsX, or on Facebook by searching the title of the book. Rob, always a pleasure to have you on, and look forward to having you back sometime soon.
Bob, thanks again.
My pleasure. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And folks, for more original interviews with your favorite journalists or website entrepreneurs, you can surf over to our main website, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. And you can follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, twitter.com/andelman, or on Facebook, just search Mr. Media Interviews. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate you sharing a piece of your day with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening.